podcast. I'm Barney, British PhD student looking at philosophy of religion.
I'm Nadia, Canadian PhD student looking at interreligious dialogue in Hinduism and Christianity.
I'm Mark. I'm sometimes not really sure who I am, but I guess the vital statistics are that I'm trained to be ordained in the Church of England, and I'm studying for a PhD in theology.
In our first podcast, we talked about one thing that we all have in common, which is that we all grew up evangelical, with evangelical parents and evangelical churches, and we shared some of the spiritual journey that that took us on. In this podcast, we'd like to share, riffing off one of the other things that we have in common, which is that we've all grown in appreciation for liturgy. And on the basis of that, we thought we'd share some thoughts about Christmas, since Christmas is coming up. I know we said in the last podcast that we were going to talk about having open and closed spirituality, but we're going to postpone that for the next one.
So I was just wondering for both of you, are you attending churches right now that use a liturgy, or because you're you're laughing?
I'm laughing because in the Church of England, there it's really diverse. Functionally, to a degree, and you get everything from kind of churches that would really only ever use set written liturgy, and churches like the one that I attend, which uses only a very small amount of that. So I'm laughing because it's the subject of some teasing in college that I go to a church that doesn't really use much set liturgy, which I don't mind, but yeah, it just makes me laugh because I get teased for that quite a lot.
How about you, Barney?
So for the past couple of years, I've been going along to my local Catholic church, which obviously is liturgical, because every Catholic church is liturgical. I did have some initial inner opposition to that. I mean, even though we're talking about Christmas, I always celebrated Christmas. I didn't think of it as a part of the liturgical calendar when I was growing up. It was just something that we all did, just like we also celebrated Easter. But for more liturgical churches, Christmas is only one of the more important parts of this whole calendar throughout the year, where different parts of the Christian story are celebrated. So when I started to see it that way, I saw my celebration in a liturgical way not as something brand new, but as just filling out something that I already did all along.
What about you, Nadia?
Yeah, the church that I went to when I was younger never had any liturgical practices. I don't think I even heard the word until going away to university. And
just to be clear, when you say no liturgical practices, you mean like there was no discernible patterns of what was said, or you mean no written liturgies?
No written liturgies, I guess.
I think that, that's just an interesting thing that you can perhaps chat about it later, but the sense I think a lot of people have is that, oh, there's no liturgy at my church. We don't like that. But the reality is often that there is. It's just not written. It's a verbal tradition of, like, the things people tend to say. But, I mean, I guess what we're talking about is an appreciation for, like, written liturgies as something distinct, which is like, yeah, we're consciously choosing to say the same thing.
Yeah, I think there wasn't that. If there was a practice of it, it was one that I wasn't really exposed to, I guess, at my church. But then when I was in university, on and off, I attended a church service that my university put on, which I think used a Celtic liturgy. Like, they just called it the Celtic service, so I don't know what tradition it drew from. But I remember there was one, I guess it would be called a prayer. I think it's the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. It's Christ is a light, illumine and guide us. Christ is a shield, overshadow us. Do either of you know this one?
Yeah.
Christ, so
It's like a really famous prayer from the Celtic tradition.
Okay, yeah. So I remember that was my first exposure to, or at least it felt like my first exposure to liturgy. And I loved that. I really, really liked it because, I don't know, I like poetry. I like, I like that. But it felt also very, very different because I think growing up in a church that didn't do that kind of thing, that thing was looked upon as kind of what people who don't have a relationship with Jesus do, right? Like they use that kind of ritual and it's cold and it's dead and it's old stuff.
It's religion.
It's not faith. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So the church I grew up in I don't think they would have used the words like looked down upon, but I felt like they would have looked down upon people who used a liturgy because that would have thought like, oh, you just have this old tradition. You don't have a real relationship with Jesus. So that was kind of a big shift for me.
I certainly would have looked down on you when I was at university, undergrad, because I really saw that distinction between religion and relationship, and I would tell even my non-Christian friends, oh yeah, I'm not religious, I'm just in a relationship with Jesus.
Yes, I remember saying things like that as well at some point, so yeah.
Actually, I mean, I remember, I don't know how many years ago it was, I think within the last 2 years, there was a popular video, I think it was a kind of like poetry slam kind of thing, a guy talking about the distinction between religion and faith or relationship or whatever, and that was like a really distinctive moment for me of feeling, you know, sort of really angry and like, oh, you know, just don't understand religion, you know, it's not the thing you're kind of making it out to be, it's such a misunderstanding, but that was like within the sort of niche evangelical world that I was and still am connected to. It was like a total sensation, this video. So it perfectly describes why religion is this terrible thing.
Yeah, well, it's still a very popular trope. I go and teach at a YWAM discipleship training school once a year, and when I'm there, I hear constantly this idea. There's even a song they sing, which the chorus is, I'm laying down all my religion.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's led me to want to think a little bit, or just to ask the question, what is meant by religion?
Yeah. Ooh, you know I'm a religious studies scholar, right? So this question is bread and butter to us. What is religion, right?
What is meant by it for these people who contrast it?
Yeah.
And my own first stab at answering that is that I think what is associated with religion when it's seen as a negative thing is a kind of inauthentic, mindless repetition of certain rituals or of certain words or of certain practices, which is perhaps, yeah, it's not from the heart or it's not fully meant with all of who you are.
It's a head thing, not a heart thing, like that kind of...
Yeah, quite possibly.
Yeah.
The funny thing is that I think, if I could be so bold, there is a there's something of a kind of rediscovery of religion in that sense of repetition. So if you think about spirituality practices, older spirituality practices that involve maybe silent meditation or some sort of repetition, you know, very short prayers to repeat. I think there is a kind of a bit of a rediscovery of that as spiritual practice. And I think it goes to show that what people from my kind of background tend to think of as that negative kind of religiosity actually has like a surprisingly like nourishing and freeing impact potentially. And so it turns out to kind of be the opposite of what you thought it might be, or having the opposite effect of what you thought it might be.
Yeah, well, I think we have to ask ourselves what we really mean by the need to be authentic.
Yeah.
Or the need for things to be from the heart, because that could contain that idea of being authentic could contain a number of different elements, some of which are important and some of which are less important.
Yeah. I know in conservative circles that I have spent time in, there was the criticism of, like, Pharisees and everything being like, see, even Jesus was not interested in religion, right? Like, yes. These ideas about, see, he wasn't interested in the kind of just do a ritual for the sake of doing a ritual. Like, Jesus was about something different, right? Like, this would have been the kind of explanation given.
Or, like, he came to, like, destroy religion is one of the popular ones, too. You know, yeah. It's the very thing, like, you know, that was part of his mission.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't, like, it's ironic because I would actually say that now I have much more of, like, a religious ritual kind of practice than I do a relationship with God. If I were to talk about my spiritual practice, that's what I would say. Like, I actually really like ritual now. Mm. Really like, I started using, like, prayer beads and things that I don't actually know how to use them properly, right? I don't know how to pray a Hail Mary or anything like this, but, like, I like using ritual objects. I like doing things on repeat. I like using old liturgies. I like the idea that I'm doing and participating in saying the same words that people have said for how many hundreds or thousands of years. Yeah. Whereas now the idea of, like, a relationship with God is something that I don't find is a part of my practice right now. Mm. So it's kind of like, yeah, I've gone quite, I've inverted my ways of seeing those two things, I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting you bring up this contrast between Jesus and the Pharisees, because I think a lot is often made of that.
Hmm.
But I think that when I go back and reread those passages where Jesus conflicts with the Pharisees in the Gospels, I see that he certainly is attacking them on the basis of them not being authentic. But their inauthenticity, Jesus keeps saying, it's actually hypocrisy. It's that they're claiming...
Interesting, yeah.
They're claiming one thing and living a different way. So,
right. As opposed to...
Well, as opposed to...
Like, you could do a ritual and not be hypocritical about it, right?
Yeah, so I think authenticity for evangelical worship, or for worship that tries to avoid liturgy, often means that your word has to correspond to your personal feelings. You have to feel the way that you're talking.
Mm.
Whereas I think when Jesus talks about the Pharisees being inauthentic, what he's saying is that their words don't correspond to their actions.
Mm.
He's not complaining about how they feel, that they're saying things they don't feel. He's saying they're saying things that they don't do. And it's the lived life being authentic that Jesus really cares about.
I think you've really touched on something pretty foundational in my own observations and my own experience too, which is that, like, I remember really clearly being in Bible college in London, and part of the kind of community practice was to have, you know, like, basically mini church services. I can't remember whether it was once or twice a week, but regularly. And as a part of that, because it was a kind of, you know, evangelical Bible college with lots of pretty talented musicians, there was the kind of band style worship music. And I remember, because I went to a charismatic church as a sort of 18, 19 year old at university, and hadn't really darkened the doorstep of that sort of church since leaving, which, I don't know, been like 5 or 6 years, something like that. So coming back to that style of music was quite difficult for me, that style of worship service. And I remember thinking, like, just looking around the room at other people looking, like, very, very sincere and kind of, like, there was some sort of an emotional happening that I felt like I wasn't experiencing. And it was, like, moderately traumatic, kind of thinking, either they're all kind of suffering from delusion, or there's something wrong with me. And I kind of more easily tend to think that it's probably me. And actually, I think that experience is very, very common. Like, for people to have a sense that they feel like their sort of religious beliefs don't really match up with the kind of emotional feelings that they perceive to be expected of them in a church service, particularly more kind of charismatic church. And that causes them some level of anxiety or trauma. So I think when, well, certainly for me, when I experienced all of these written prayers that I, you know, of the Roman Catholic tradition, of the Anglican tradition, I find them hugely liberating, because there is something about just being able to speak a prayer with no perceived kind of emotional expectation on me that was just massively freeing. And I think that is quite a common experience. People engage with written liturgy in an enthusiastic way because it puts less emotional demand on them. And so...
Such a good point.
I think it's really important recognizing where we are historically. So the kind of modern sense of self has just changed hugely. So what we perceive to be kind of hypocrisy, you know, you're not kind of really feeling it, is totally different to what, you know, the challenge might have been at a different stage of history, because we have this kind of slightly dualistic sense of the self.
Yeah, well, I think it's our stage of history is an interesting one to think about, and I'd love to hear from you in a minute, Nadia, about what you think about Eastern traditions and how they might differ from this. But as far as Western history is concerned, I think there's a very interesting shift in the understanding of what is meant by the heart. When we talk about the heart now, we tend to mean emotions, we tend to mean feelings.
Yeah.
Whereas that's a shift that went on about 250 years ago with the rise of the movement known as the Romantic movement, Romanticism, which originated in Germany, where feelings and emotions, deep feelings, became the centre of who you are. The most important part, the driving force behind who you are, was your feelings. But of course, before then, in most cultures of the world, the heart didn't refer to your feelings at all. It referred to your will.
Mm.
It referred to your choice of the kind of person you are living your life as. But I think the role of feelings is a very important one to tease out.
Mm.
Whether it's inauthentic to be saying words if you're not feeling the emotions that correspond to the words that you're saying. Mm.
That's what I had wanted to pick up on when Mark was speaking, because you said that it's not... you said it's not as emotionally demanding to participate in a liturgy. And I was thinking at first, I was like, yeah, I agree. That's why I love liturgy, because, you know, I don't have to conjure up these feelings of love for Jesus, which may not, you know, arise at this point in my life. So at some point it feels very freeing and it's a very welcome thing. But then I also know, which I think I mentioned in our last episode, is that even just sometimes saying things like the Apostles' Creed, I don't know if I can say those words, because what if I don't believe what the words are saying, and the Father, the Son, I believe in the virgin birth, right? Things that, you know, they don't really align with my thoughts. So that actually can be quite demanding on an emotional level.
It's just different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of emotional dynamic, I think.
Absolutely.
The way that it puts emotional demand on you, as opposed to whether it puts emotional demand in you. Because the reality is that, you know, as sort of whole beings, you can't take emotion out of anything. We are emotional as part of who we are.
Mm.
And actually, I think there's a real danger of thinking in sort of those compartmentalizing terms. But I think that's a really helpful thing to identify. It's just, it's a different kind of emotional dynamic.
Yeah, it's not as if emotions aren't important. I I remember talking to one of the lecturers, one of the theology lecturers at the University of Cambridge, who also grew up evangelical, and told me once that when he was, you know, a teenager and a young adult, he felt this enormous pressure to be feeling constantly joyful and happy at worship services, that it was all about, essentially, it became all about him and how he was feeling rather than about God and who God was. And then he described the first time he walked into a high Anglican church service, a liturgical church service, and he described it this way. He said, they told me to bow my head because God was holy, and it had nothing to do with how I felt about it.
Yeah.
And of course, in some way, that there's a feeling that comes with that too. It's not that the feeling doesn't matter. The feeling is, it's not about me.
I heard someone talking recently in really overtly, you know, emotional language about the sheer joy and exhilaration they get from using the Book of Common Prayer within the Church of England.
Mm.
They come out of a more Anglo-Catholic tradition than I do. It was quite an insightful moment of kind of, you know, people don't engage with this because it allows them to kind of put their emotions aside. Actually, they get great joy, they get great kind of satisfaction and exhilaration from using language which they find to be just utterly beautiful. Yeah, so I think that's kind of a positive aspect on it.
Yeah, I wonder if we could go from this talking about emotions to also talk about the emotions surrounding Christmas time. Because in a way, I hope I'm not making too big of a leap. It makes sense in my mind. Let me try to explain it. Christmas is for all, you know, let's just say it's a celebration of the birth of Jesus Christ, right? Like that's a pretty fair definition of Christmas, right?
Yeah. I'm happy with that.
Okay. And so then what do you do when you're caught between this Christian expression of a relationship and a Christian expression of tradition and ritual and reverence? Like, and I don't want to dichotomize those in a way that, like, they don't have to be such a rigid binary where you're not doing both at once or whatever, but I think, like, from my own experience, having gone from, yeah, being very much a relational, like a pro-relationship with Jesus kind of Christian at one point in my life, to now being something a lot more, if I fall into any Christian category at all, it's a lot more just the admiration and interest in ritual, spiritual activity, right? Like, I'm like, well, what do I do with a day that celebrates, you know, the birth of someone who I used to think I had a really close relationship with? And now I'm just kind of toying with the idea of using Christian traditions, ways of having ritual or having spiritual practice. And like that to me is an extremely emotionally demanding question, but in a way that, for both parts of it, it's like this kind of battling with a former relational question, and it's battling with a current interest and intrigue in the ritual. Like I attended an Advent service a few nights ago at Trinity College Chapel. It was so beautiful. It was candlelit. It was amazing music. Like, I loved every moment of it. But that, to me, was a very ritual activity. And that had nothing to do with kind of a relational idea of Christ coming, you know. Where do you guys fall on that, if either of you want to jump in?
Gosh, I don't know.
It's a big question.
Because you see what I mean, right? So we've got a day that is celebrating, without getting into any kind of historical overview of whether this day is a good day to celebrate the birth of Jesus or whatever, but we've got a day that is celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ. And then we've got people who, some of whom view this person to be the person who they've got a divine relationship with, right? Like, you talk to Jesus the way you talk to a friend. And we've got other people who are really interested in the traditions and the spiritual rituals that have been passed down through Christian communities over the years. both of them are kind of centered around this idea of, well, there is the birth of Jesus, but they're doing that in very different ways.
Mm.
Yeah, well, I guess the original point of having an annual celebration of the birth of Jesus was, well, it was never in isolation in the original Christian calendar. As I said at the beginning, it was part of this continual celebration throughout the year of different elements of the Christian story. And first of all, it wasn't an individual thing at all. It wasn't about your or my individual relationship to anyone. It was a communal thing. And the community was wanting to relive the story that shaped their initial identity. And I don't think there's anything particularly unusual about that in Christianity. I think every religion, but even not just religions, every community, every movement celebrates key markers in the year that represent things that happened in their history that gave shape to their identity.
Yeah. I remember learning that actually in early Christian communities didn't actually celebrate the birth of Jesus until about the 4th century. Up until that point, they focused almost exclusively on celebrating the resurrection. But it was around the 4th century or so where people began thinking, hey, we should also recognize, you know, the birth at some point. But that actually came like almost 400 years in, right? So.
Yeah, that's right. The resurrection has traditionally been the far more important celebration.
Mm.
And that's why there's a 40-day fast leading up to the celebration of the resurrection, whereas there's only a 24-day fast leading up to the celebration of Christmas.
Mm.
It's only in our own Western culture that, for some reason, Christmas has become far more significant in marking our calendar. Actually, now that I think about it, probably the reason is Christmas was originally placed on what was thought to be the winter solstice.
Yeah.
It was meant to be the darkest moment of the year, which symbolises the darkest moment of history. So the moment when there is no hope, when there's complete obscurity, that's the moment when Jesus enters for the first time as a little baby.
Mm.
And so because of that, it just ends up that Christmas is right at the end of the year, which is a helpful way of marking.
Yeah. I mean, lest we get sidetracked, that date was also chosen because there was already an existing Roman tradition, which was celebrated around that time, celebrating Mithra, I forget the name of this sun god, but that's kind of why the date itself was chosen as well.
Yeah, I mean, all the early Christian rituals and traditions didn't see any problem with borrowing what was good about previous religions and traditions. They didn't want to see themselves as this radical break with everything that came before, but rather taking up into themselves everything that was good that came from before.
Yeah.
And that's very true when you look at things like Christmas and Easter and Halloween, all of which were originally pagan celebrations and became Christian ones.
Mm. One of the challenges I find about Advent and Christmas is that the reality for me, and I think a lot of people, is that we are hugely invested in it and enjoy it a lot because it is a way of dealing with the mundanity and the challenge of life, but then particularly, you know, the darkest point of winter, where there's a ton of like seasonal affective disorder going on, and like, you know, maybe you're really challenged at work or whatever, and the kind of joy of having a bunch of sparkly lights up everywhere and thinking about, you know, time you're maybe going to spend with your family or whatever.
Yeah, and this is what Christmas actually used to be celebrated as. Historians would say that before 1800s in England, if you were to be out and around Christmas time, it would look like a carnival. There's tons of people just drinking lots, having lots of celebrations in the street. Christmas was actually banned in certain years because people did not want to have the public celebrating in this way. So, like, in 1652, Christmas was outlawed. Like, that happened, right?
That's
like,
hilarious.
People were really just focused on having a good time in the dead of winter when everything was...
I mean, I think that's basically still the same, or it's true again. It's like, you know, like, office Christmas parties tend to be pretty wild, and, yeah... People love that until maybe the morning after, but I think the sort of unique challenge or new challenge of this particular era, certainly it is for me anyway, is that in a globalized world where I'm aware that I am rich and fat, how do I square...
You're not that fat, by the way.
In global standards, you know... But so point to that sense of, like, excess. You know, we live, you know, in the excess. We have so much. How do I square that sense of, like, it's not wrong. I mean, I'm totally invested in Christmas being a time of celebration. It's something really good. Advent kind of gives you enough steam to sort of keep going until you have a break. How do I deal with that when I know that, even within my own country, like, there's a ton of people who have nowhere to sleep, across the pond, circumstances are completely different. How do you get that sense of balance of Christmas and Advent being, you know, a good time to, like, enjoy and just be merry and cope with the mundanity of life when you know that your neighbours, are struggling? And I think for me, I want to kind of get that balance of recovery of some sort of genuine theological meaning of what Christmas is, and like the power of what the incarnation might possibly mean, and yet just be quite straightforward about enjoying Christmas time, if there's any coherence in what I've just said.
Well, there is a tradition of making Christmas a special time to think about the poor as well.
Yeah.
And many churches today still go out of their way to have homeless shelters and to give a lot of the excess food generated from feasts just to give it to the poor straight away. That's the tradition of Boxing Day and where that came from.
Mm.
You were putting your spare food in boxes and giving it
to
the poor.
Yeah, yeah.
Looks a little different now, though, doesn't it? Boxing Day, yeah. But Mark, for you, so you're saying, I mean, you're saying two things, right? You're saying there's something about the theological side of Christmas.
Mm.
And then there's also just, you know what, this is a time with family. This is a time to be merry. This is a time to let loose a little bit. Yeah, I think that second one makes total sense to me. Obviously, the UK is so dark and dreary in these months. And I think we need to be intentional about having fun with family, with friends, all of that. It's the theological side of it that mystifies me. Like, what is it that we are, like, theologically, what is it that we are celebrating? Are we celebrating the birth of God? Like is that what people today are still, I'm not sure of the words. That's a thing that they are gathering around and believing that, and like I find that difficult to wrap my head around now. So,
I think for me, like, going back to kind of where we started talking about written liturgies, that is something I appreciate a lot about most Christian traditions, actually, is Advent is a time when churches tend to sort of up their game on their Sunday services with, like, carol services and... There's often quite a bit of extra creativity put into it. For example, the church I attend in Cambridge, Holy Trinity, last year, one of the services, I can't remember which one it was now, in Advent, was just absolutely magnificent and like a huge surprise. I was relatively new to the church, so I didn't kind of realise how gifted the person employed to do music was. But the service that he put on was not what you kind of typically expect in a charismatic church, and was like deeply liturgical, like drew on imagery as well as kind of words and music. And I think mystery and kind of, you know, as an experience is something which now I try not to resolve. I try for it to be something which is an experience in and of itself. It's not something to be understood. It is mystery, unresolvable. And I really appreciate that in many churches, Advent is a pretty good time to experience liturgical church at its best in various different traditions.
I think for me personally, Christmas is associated in my mind with rest, comfort, family, and just recuperation. And all of that is bound up in these annual rituals where we read the same Bible passages, which look at the birth of Christ and sing the same Christmas carols. And I enjoy that because of the yearly pattern that it puts you in a mindset, if you feel that way, the same time every year.
But then the birth actually doesn't seem to hold a lot of significance then, other than being a placeholder for ritual to happen.
For me, I still maintain, or maybe I could even say I maintain again, because I find Advent and Christmas really hard, in that I feel very privileged that like I'm not really lonely, I'm not really that poor, my family is not really very broken. And I'm aware for a lot of people, Christmas just amplifies loneliness and brokenness, and is a time of like quite a lot of misery, actually. And so for me, like, I hold on really dearly to the incarnation as some embodiment of hope beyond what is now, because I find it like cripplingly difficult to think about. Well, it seems kind of unfair that, you know, I've ended up in this situation and someone else has ended up in another situation, and I don't know how to reconcile that. So for me, like, just some like simple theology of the incarnation is of great hope and comfort to me at a time when I feel a tension.
I agree, except I appreciate and I smile that you say, oh, the simple theology of the incarnation. I'm like, that's so complicated, though. That's so complicated.
But what I mean is being intentionally simple about it.
Because
there is a time to be complicated, and I think there is a time to be simple.
Okay, yeah.
A second naivete, you might even say.
Mm.
Well, I think for me it's very important that Jesus was born theologically. But you're right, Nadia, in pointing out that I perhaps don't associate that as much as I should, or I don't think about that as much as I should in the context of Christmas. I just think about that as a general theological tenet as part of my way of engaging with my faith. But yeah, maybe I should think more about how to front load that or focus on that as part of the Christmas celebration.
Mm-hmm. I think Christmas for me is mostly about, well, at this point, it's I'm thinking of this candlelight Advent service again and how beautiful that was. I can't wait to have people over to my home, and I want to do something like a candlelit dinner or a candlelit musical jam session, like something just beautiful and
sounds very organic. Beauty though.
Yeah, yeah.
Make sure you get the essential oils right though.
Yeah, I will. I'll get like cinnamon and clove and frankincense. Maybe some myrrh, you know, Christmas, yeah. I feel like there's so many directions that we could have taken this one today, and even in the middle of it, we could have gone off on several different tangents, and it might be interesting to follow up on some of those in future discussions. So for example, Barney, hearing more about your process of joining a liturgical church and moving out of an evangelical one and what that was like, or Mark, to hear from you also about what is it like to be trained and to now be ordained as a priest in the Church of England, and what has that been like? I think it'd be really interesting to hear more about that. So maybe we can talk about that next time. But yeah, in the meantime, have a good Advent and Merry Christmas.